I'm Jonathan Aberman. Coming up on today's show,
the next vertical to come is all these things that we in this region have sort of like thought we were immune to innovation on. But you know what? Sort of the taxi industry, I also think that they were immune to it. But when's the last time you actually booked a taxi by making a phone call?
Welcome to What's Working in Washington on Federal News Network and streaming as a podcast.
Silicon Valley is coming for our local industry. I'm here to tell you it's a fact. Silicon Valley specializes in product companies. How do you make something once and sell it to many people? We specialize in innovation delivered to our most important customer on a tailored basis, something we call service or consulting. The two industries are very different. The profit margins are different. The growth opportunities are different. And the profits and what you get from winning are very different. Silicon Valley wants to bring their model to national security. Well, how are we going to defend ourselves from this competitive threat? We have to become better ourselves at building technology products. Ben Foster is the co-founder of the product advisory practice of Prodify. Like many of my friends here in town, he's chosen to build his entrepreneurial journey here in the region because it's a wonderful place to be. And he's going to talk about how a Silicon Valley mindset has shaped his career and will help you understand how to compete and win in a product-driven world. Here's our conversation. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I always appreciate the opportunity.
Well, absolutely. You're one of my go-to guys and always have been around this issue. So we have a lot of listeners that are involved in different parts of the industry here in town. A lot of people are involved in government contracting, serving the national security customer. Let's start with just a definitional thing. How would you describe a product-driven technology entrepreneurship from, say, the service or consulting model that many of the people in our region are familiar with?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting, and I run into this question all the time. I think people are confused about the difference between the two because there's so many commonalities. You know, you're delivering technology, you're trying to understand what the customer needs are, you're trying to ensure that you meet or exceed those each time. You know, you're getting your revenue, you've got your cost to serve. There's so many things that seem on the surface like they're really common. But in reality, you take a little bit of a step back and you realize that these things are fundamentally different. So you've got a services company. Really fundamentally what you're doing is you're meeting your potential customer first. You're understanding what their individual needs are, and then you're looking for ways that you can meet those needs for that customer. And then you rinse and repeat, and you keep doing that customer by customer, but you're always doing one at a time. What happens in a product company is it's kind of like, it seems like it's nuanced, but it's actually like radically different, which is you talk to a variety of customers. You try to understand what the common threads are across customers to define the market, and then you build one single solution that's going to solve all those problems for all of those customers. And then you try to like make that scale a lot better. And so, you know, it's a lot higher risk to be a product company, but it's a lot higher reward when you can get it right as well.
So in simple terms, being the grandson of a tailor, it's the difference between a tailored suit and an off the rack suit. But okay. So you just said something interesting about rewards. Because I must say that some of the most successful entrepreneurs I know have grown and sold tremendous government contracting businesses. So explain the difference when you say that the product companies can be more rewarding. What are you getting at there?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, you can look at it a couple of different ways. Certainly, you know, go to the NASDAQ and see what the top listed companies are and how many of them are product companies versus services companies, right? So it depends on the kind of scale that you're talking about. If you want to get to $10 million of revenue, you're not going to have any real problem doing that as a services company if you can be really good at what you do. But you're not going to find yourself in that $50 million, $100 million, you know, $1 billion range, except for the very elite few that have happened to kind of get to that stage because they've, you know, built so much infrastructure around it, et cetera. But even in a lot of those companies, whether they're the Accentures of the world or the BCGs, et cetera, you know, they've invested so much in productization of the kinds of solutions that they're providing to their customers that in reality, while they may feel like they're a little bit more bespoke or, you know, specific to the individual needs of the companies that they're serving, there's a lot of commonalities to the way that they're serving those customers as well. So, you know, it depends on what kind of scale you're really looking to achieve. But the reason that I think that this happens and the reason that investors pay so much more attention to product companies is because of the potential for scale, because you've already built the thing that the next customer needs, right? That's kind of like the idea here. So you've already invested the time into that. You've already built the technology. All you got to do is flip a switch and turn that next customer on, as opposed to having to start the whole entire thing from scratch again. And so while a lot of companies, I think from a, like, let's say a financial perspective, are able to get away with taking this work that's going to specific customers and calling it R&D because you've got an engineer writing code, et cetera. The reality is we all kind of know that that's actually cost of goods sold, right? You know, because you're going to have to go do that again for the next customer that you haven't yet met, versus in a product company, you have actually done that work. It is true R&D effort, and now you get to reap the rewards of that on the other side.
It sounds to me that another reason why product companies are financially rewarded is because once you've created the product and you don't have to build it again, that means that you're selling the same thing again and again, which means that your costs of goods sold are significantly less. And so your profit margins are going to be much greater.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, you know, your profit margins end up being a lot greater, but also think about what it does in terms of your ability to lower the cost of delivery. So, you know, in reality, there are costs that, you know, that we all pay for SaaS products and things like that that we use that are relatively low. And it would be impossible, you know, to think about using HubSpot as a small business, or you think about using, you know, Google Sheets and you know, and any of these kind of like basic tools that you're sort of like, you know, used to. The cost of, you know, of those tools for your business is so low because they're getting the benefits of scale. You know, their production costs of those tools are much more massive than any sort of like one-off solution that might be delivered for any given customer. But the unit economics are such that if they get 10 million customers using the same product, then of course, you know, that gets that cost of development gets divided 10 million different ways. And that means that they have now the ability to lower their costs, right? And now what happens is, I think you tend to find this over time, is that these one-off solutions end up later getting displaced by products as product companies become more and more aware of the revenue that there is to be made by competing with you as a services company. You may realize that you're kind of like dead in the water at some point, because you can never potentially hit the type of unit economics that your competitors can. And so, yes, they can either enjoy wider margins than you do, but more often than not, they end up eating your lunch, because they lower their prices into a place that would be prohibitively inexpensive for you and turn your economics upside down.
You mentioned lunch, so I'm getting hungry, which makes me think of donuts. And donuts are a product. So are you talking about donuts when you talk about products? What are you talking about?
Well, I always think about this in the technology space. You know, I'm primarily a technology guy myself. I've been around Silicon Valley my whole career, et cetera. Now, you know, whether you think about products or services in the world of, you know, food retail and things like that, you can probably use a variety of different terms for those kinds of things. But in the world that I'm talking about, I'm really talking about this difference in how a technology company operates, whether they kind of take this more services-driven model of saying, I'm going to get to success by saying yes to these one-off requests that I'm getting from these different customers that I'm meeting, or these product-based companies that are saying, hey, I'm going to go figure out and try to figure out the nuance of what are all these different kinds of requests that I'm hearing from different customers, identifying the single ideal product that's going to meet the needs of the market, even if it's not perfect for any individual customer, but then take that to much bigger, greater scale. Because in your example of a donut, you still have to make 1,000 donuts to feed 1,000 people. In the case of software, you actually only have to make one donut and you could still feed 1,000 people with one donut.
Really, I could beat this analogy to death, but I'm not going to. I'm going to stop myself. So product, technology, almost definitionally is the place where product occurs. You know, before we delve into that a little bit more, it sounds to me like doing a product company is a lot riskier, right? Because you don't, yeah, I'm not crazy.
No, not at all. I mean, that's why you tend to see so much more of the traditional kind of like VC, you know, investment space going into product companies, because they need the capital to be able to build something that's good enough that is going to serve the needs of a lot of different customers simultaneously. And they're taking a lot of risk as they're doing those builds, because what happens if you build this thing and you sort of like hope that that next customer that you meet is going to say, yeah, that's actually a good enough product for me. It's better than all the competitor ones. The economics make sense. Yes, I want to buy this, et cetera. When you haven't had a chance to just have like a one-on-one conversation with them, learn about the exact specific things that they need, and then build exactly towards that. So it is sort of like naturally higher risk because there's more intensive investment that needs to happen up front, but also because you don't know on the other side whether your customers are actually going to want to buy that product or not until you actually take it to market. But that's after you've made all this investment. Contrast that with the services company, where I go meet my customer first. I learn what it is that they want from me. I go build towards that. They pay me immediately, and I get to sort of, you know, pay, you know, for the salaries of the people on my team, et cetera. And I can use that to go to market the next time around to the next customer. So it's almost like the difference between linear growth and exponential growth, where you get this linear growth from a services company. And every time you're successful, you can kind of like parlay that into a little bit more investment to go find the next customer as well. But in the product company, you have more upfront development. And so your economics don't necessarily look as good in the very beginning. But when they take off and you get to that product market fit, things really take off in a way that you would never be able to see if you were continuing to run the businesses and services company.
So that's why when people talk about technology product companies, why it's so high risk, high reward. If you hit it right, the margins are exceptional. You have an iPhone or a Google. But if you get it wrong, you're going to waste a lot of money. That's going to come from investors because there's no revenue. And it's just a spectacular flame out. Right, which is why VC is such a binary activity. Speaking as a venture investor, and I've seen more than my fair share of successes and flameouts. You know, Ben, you've been around this for a while. We're here with Ben Foster, co-founder of the product advisory practice at Prodify. Ben, you've been here in this region. You chose to be in this region. You came here from the Valley. You know, Opower, various of the companies you've been involved in. What's the story with product innovation here? I know the government contract industry and the service industry is strong here. What's your assessment of product-driven entrepreneurship?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's not the same as Silicon Valley. Let's be, you know, blunt and honest about that reality. But that's in part because a lot of the infrastructure that surrounds those startups is kind of like missing here in a way that it isn't, you know, over in California, the Bay Area, you know, New York or Boston, et cetera. And that's because there's sort of like this infrastructure of capital investment that's going into companies like that. It's also a little bit of a difference in the culture. You know, if you go to a party and tell somebody you work at a startup with five, you know, people in a garage, you know, over here, people are like, what, that sounds crazy. Like, why aren't you kind of climbing the corporate ladder at a larger firm or something like that? And over in California, they'll be like, oh, that's really cool. Like, of course, you know, you've got the same story as many others. And so what's sort of like deemed normal, what seems like a legitimate level of risk to be taking on and seems sort of like fun and interesting versus irresponsible, it's just sort of, you have a little bit of a different zeitgeist that's there. So I think that there are those differences between the different regions. But the main thing is, look, investment dollars follow a path of success. And I think that's that right. What you've seen is you've seen a lot of venture capital firms get very wealthy by making investments that have paid really big dividends elsewhere. And you haven't had as many success stories here yet. And it's not to say that we couldn't have them. In fact, in a lot of ways, there's a lot of advantages that I think this region potentially has. If we just tap into those advantages, it'd be fantastic. But one of the big ones that stands out to me is the number of people who have the right kind of talent, the right kinds of experience and capability, et cetera, is phenomenal. You've got a lot of people who've been working on technology solutions with big data, and they've been doing things that are close to AI and ML and all these other kind of like hot topics, you know, that are going on right now. But they've been working on these kinds of things at massive scale for government entities, for contractors, for government entities, et cetera. So you have this sort of like labor pool that I think is very, very talented, very, very diverse, very, very sort of, you know, well-educated, et cetera. And it's just got to be coupled, I think, with that willingness to take those levels of risk, like we were talking about, to be willing, you know, to try to get that 100x improvement or that 100x kind of like, you know, valuation, as opposed to just kind of like, you know, trying to bat a single every single time.
I agree. And when we come back, we're going to make the argument, you and I, for why this is a great time for people to make that change. I'm here with Ben Foster, co-founder of the product advisor practice at Prodify. We'll be right back. we're back with Ben Foster, co-founder of the product advisor practice at Prodify, which, by the way, you can find him at prodify.group. Relatively recently, I wrote a column in the Business Journal and pointed out that Silicon Valley, as you just described, is they're experts at technology product companies. The venture capital community is experts at funding them. There is a growing trend in Silicon Valley now of forming and financing national security-focused technology product startups. Y Combinator, the most important technology accelerator startup group in the world, but certainly in the United States, has specifically said that they're going to focus on national security companies. And Andreessen Horowitz, probably if not the most influential venture capitalist in the Valley, has here regularly now lobbying the federal government to buy technology product from companies in Silicon Valley. And so I believe that the region now faces an existential threat. For the first time, product is no longer a luxury that others do, but we can ignore. I think product is going to come and, frankly, disintermediate us away from our primary customer. If the Federal Reserve, if federal government starts buying tech products and we don't do products here, where's it going to leave our local industries, your local industry? So I'm really worried about it. And I want you to advocate, if you can, hopefully I've gotten people's attention, advocate, if you can, why and how our local government contractors and service companies, who are tremendous companies, can adopt more of a product focus to compete with Silicon Valley and win.
Yeah, you know, first I'll just layer on to what you were saying there. I think it's such an important point. You know, if you wind the clock back 10 minutes in our conversation, I think, you know, we were just talking about how a product company can be successful, not just because they can enjoy higher margins, but because they can actually have an opportunity to eat the lunch of a competitor that's a services company, because their cost of goods sold is always going to be higher because they're having to build it one off every single time. Whereas a product kind of company can kind of come in and actually deliver the product at a lower price than what your cost would even be in the first place. So their, you know, economics are fantastic. Yours are really poor. And I think that's why you see the same kind of thing happening in terms of disintermediation of industry after industry after industry, right? I mean, go back to the early days of the internet, and like, travel agents used to be a really big thing, right? But like, when's the last time you booked your last trip through a travel agent, as opposed to doing the whole entire thing online, right? Or, you know, booking it through some sort of, you know, a product based, you know, platform that allows you to find your own flights and things like that as well. So there are these services that are naturally just sort of like going to expire over time. And you either have to make some form of investment one way or another to prevent that from happening. You don't just get to sort of like enjoy the spoils of being there, because every time you're successful, you're also advertising to the world of Silicon Valley and everybody else how lucrative it potentially could be, if only they could. Yeah, exactly. Right. So, so your own success is sort of like your own demise at the same time, unless you continue to innovate. And I think that's, you know, a really important part of this. And it probably, you know, brings me to really answering your question here, Jonathan, of, you know, how do you go about addressing this? You don't stop innovating. And it's important that you innovate on the behalf of the customer. And this is such an important nuance. I think so many services companies sort of fall into the trap of saying, okay, well, I'm just going to ask you what you're looking for. I'll build exactly to your specifications, whatever I happen to see in an RFP or, you know, RFI or anything like that. And instead, what you got to do is say, hey, look, let me understand the problem it is that you're trying to tackle. Now, companies that are product companies naturally do this on their own because they're trying to meet the needs of multiple different customers simultaneously. That means they're always abstracting the things that they're hearing, because no two customers are ever going to say the same exact thing the same exact way. So they have to take on this burden of interpretation of what it is that the customer is really trying to solve, not the solution that they present to you, but the problem that they're trying to illustrate in their description of what they think a good solution would be. And if you can then listen to that, you can take that nuanced approach and you can apply it to say, okay, well, what if I built this for you? If I solved this for you, what other kinds of problems would it solve for you as well? Who else would it solve problems for in addition to the customer that's asking for this, right? And if you build it in such a way that it is actually repeatable, where you don't have a bunch of, you know, code that says, you know, if customer name is X, then here, you know, here's what the product's going to do in that particular, you know, instance. But to say more broadly, here's the problem that we're trying to solve and how we're going to go about solving it. That's what real innovation looks like. And just because you have historically been a services company doesn't mean that you need to continue to take that same approach going forward. You can start to move and migrate in that direction of thinking more in a product mindset.
What are some of the hallmarks that you've seen in your career where a company has gone from a service mentality to a product mentality. What are some of the things that leaders have to be able to do in order to successfully accomplish that?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of it does come back to the culture. You know, you do get to success in a sales-driven organization, which pretty much every professional services company is going to be, by finding ways of saying yes to things that customers are asking for. But there's this thing that I do when I go up on stage, you know, at some sort of, you know, show and talk about product, et cetera. And I'll say, everybody pull out your phones. And this is kind of like a funny exercise, and everybody takes out their phones and they hold them up above them. And I say, who would have traded, you know, a larger screen size for less battery? And some people hold it and some people lower it. I say, who would, you know, have a better Wi-Fi signal but sacrifice battery life? And, you know, some people hold it and some people don't. But the point is, at the end of all this, the moral of the story is you're all still holding your phone anyway, aren't you? What that means is, you know, everybody who walked into the Apple store or Verizon or, you know, wherever to go buy their phone, they all may have wanted something that was slightly different than what was offered. But the advantages to those customers of having something that was in a box ready to start using today that, you know, had software that automatically worked for it and things like that was far superior to, you know, essentially custom designing your own phone. Like, it's just not really feasible to even think about it that way, right? It would be like going to the farmer's market and asking them to grow vegetables that you want that look like this or look like that versus having them ready to go. You know, that's the difference is you choose, as a company, you have to choose, are you going to put the product out there and have it be ready to be bought? Or are you going to first try to meet these customers and then try to meet their needs after you've learned more about what they are? In order to make that transition, you can't just do that by continuing to operate as you have been historically. You have to organize yourself as a product company. So the best practices that I've seen on this is really stand up an entirely independent business unit where they have someone who's responsible for the product, for the product roadmap, for thinking about the vision for what they're going to go build, who defines what the target market actually is and which kinds of customers are going to be served and does the customer research, et cetera. Because again, even though on the surface, a lot of the same things are actually being delivered, the way that you go about getting there is just so fundamentally different. So continue to have your sales team go continue to sell your services over here, but start to make these investments to build up this product capability and then take that to market. And over time, you start to displace salespeople trying to sell these bespoke solutions to salespeople instead saying, hey, here's the product that I've got on offer. Here's what I'm going to make available to you.
So what do we need to teach our region's entrepreneurs and leaders in order for us to have more technology product companies in the region?
Yeah, I think that there's a whole ton of best practices that are available. You know, I've tried to make this available myself through work that you and I have done together on this, Jonathan. I, you know, when we did Tandem Product Academy, I think that was something that was really valuable for the people who were enrolled in that. I've done some video lessons that are available to make them readily accessible to folks. I've written a book on that called Build What Matters, etc. I think that there's a lot of sharing of best practices that can be there, as long as you're willing to dedicate the time, the resources are out there, right? I think that's something that we can certainly do. And then the other one is, I think that we should be trying to reach out to get some capital investment from outside the region as well, have that infused into the region, have that flow towards workers and things like that that are here, because there's this pattern that happens in the product world where a company is successful and it sort of spins out all these people who then go found their own companies as well. And that's why I was saying, if you can just have a few successes in the region with this, then it can beget so many more successes in the region, because now those people have seen success. The investors from elsewhere start to realize, hey, there's a lot of potential here in the DC area. You've got, you know, great workers who have a lot of, you know, skill sets and capabilities on this front, because maybe you don't have the same kind of firefight for talent as you have in the Bay Area, where, you know, engineers are getting paid $600,000 a year or something like that. And it just doesn't, you know, work unless you're like one of these behemoth type companies. But over here, there's actually great, you know, talent available at you know, reasonable price points and things like that to go build new things. So we have all the capabilities. We just have to be willing to put in the time, put in the effort. And honestly, probably the biggest one is being willing to put in the risk.
You know, I look at what New York did with Mayor Bloomberg and the Innovation Campus in Cornell with Roosevelt Island. And my biggest criticism of our region's leaders now is everybody's been playing small ball for too long. And if we keep playing small ball, we're going to continue to be irrelevant. And that sounds to me like if I could snap my fingers and find you $50 million, I think you'd put it to good use, is what it sounds like.
Yeah, I'll give you my bank account details right after this. Be great.
Well, I'll tell everybody Ben's website is prodify.group, but we won't put his wire transfer instructions. But you know, at the end of the day, this really I do think our region is. We talk about potential. We have the talent. We're facing an existential threat. It's really time for the region's successful entrepreneurs and business people to take this seriously, I think.
Yeah, totally. And you know, you've hit the nail on the head. It's not just a luxury idea anymore. It's not something that would be kind of cool in addition to the other things that we're doing. I think that the reality is you're always going to experience these threats in any particular business. And I just think the next vertical to come is all these things that we in this region have sort of like thought we were immune to innovation on. But yeah, you know what? Sort of the taxi industry, I also think that they were immune to it. But when's the last time you actually booked a taxi by making a phone call as opposed to pulling out your phone and using Uber?
Yeah, listen, I just spent 4.5 years as a dean in a local university, and I can tell you that the internet came for universities and continues to come for them and is just intermediating them like crazy. Every industry will take its turn in the barrel, I think is the way I would describe it. Listen, Ben, you've been a real resource for me. You've helped me think some things through in real time today, and hopefully others listening. This is a call to action. You know, you and I care about this region. We've been co-conspirators for a long term. Let's make something happen. And thank you very much for lending your expertise in the past and hopefully in the future.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
This program is brought to you in partnership with George Mason University's Center for Regional Analysis. The CRA is the region's leading voice in economic data and forecasting. Check out their work at cra.gmu.edu. What's Working in Washington is a team effort. We have a great team. Tracy Madigan is our executive producer and editor. Laura Latendresse is our digital producer. The theme music you've been listening to is performed by the Sunbathers. And thanks to all of you for joining us on What's Working in Washington.
You've been listening to What's Working in Washington on Federal News Network and streaming as a podcast.